Picture a 37-year-old man on a plane hearing a Beatles song through tinny speakers and suddenly being pulled back through nearly two decades of memory. That's how Haruki Murakami's Norwegian Wood begins, not with dramatic action, but with the way a melody can resurrect our past with startling intensity. The novel, named after that very song about a failed romantic encounter, became a cultural earthquake in Japan. It sold over 10 million copies, transformed Murakami from respected writer to reluctant celebrity, and forced him to flee his own country to escape the overwhelming attention. What makes a story about grief, sex, and young love resonate so deeply? Perhaps because it speaks to something universal, the way loss reshapes us and how we struggle to move forward while honoring what we've left behind. Toru Watanabe's world fractures when his best friend Kazuki kills himself at 17 without explanation. They had spent that very afternoon playing pool, laughing, making weekend plans. Those mundane details, the click of billiard balls, chalk dust floating in afternoon light, Kazuki's characteristic laugh, become haunting reminders of life's terrible unpredictability. Before this, death existed as abstraction. Now it's intimately woven into existence itself. Death's hand was extended to take Kazuki that night, Toru reflects, its sharp claws simultaneously tearing away something inside me. At 18, everything begins revolving around mortality. His survival strategy becomes methodical avoidance, steering clear of pool tables, red cars, white flowers, anything triggering painful memories. Yet inside him grows an awareness that death isn't life's opposite, but its inseparable companion. This realization forces him into profound isolation, attending lectures without passion, reading American novels while classmates debate French philosophy, living in a strict dormitory where daily flag ceremonies provide structure for his increasingly detached existence. Into Toru's emotional void steps Naoko, Kazuki's former girlfriend, encountered by chance on a Tokyo train. Their relationship begins with Sunday walks, miles of aimless wandering, comfortable silences punctuated by occasional stories. What binds them isn't just shared grief, but understanding of their unusual three-way dynamic. Naoko explains they'd been inseparable since age 3, growing up with intimacy that made them almost extensions of each other. "We were like kids on a desert island," she says, "picking bananas when hungry, sleeping in each other's arms." This perfect unity couldn't last. They eventually had to enter society, which is why Toru mattered. He was their link to the outside world. If Kazuki had lived, they would have gradually grown unhappy because they'd have to pay the world back what we owed it, the pain of growing up they'd avoided. Kazuki's suicide becomes a desperate escape from inevitable separation. Then there's Midori Kobayashi, her name literally meaning green, who embodies vibrant life in stark contrast to Naoko's fragility. Bold, sexually frank, impulsive, she approaches Toru after a lecture. When she doesn't appear for lunch, he tracks her to her family bookshop, discovering she's spending days at the hospital with her dying father. Despite losing her mother 2 years earlier to the same brain tumor now killing her father, Midori channels grief into fierce determination. "Life has been cruel to us, but we're going to get back everything it owes us." On Noako's 20th birthday, everything shifts. After wine and dinner, she speaks with unprecedented intensity about trivial childhood matters, following strange internal logic while avoiding certain subjects, Kazuki among them. Hours later, she stops mid-sentence, tears spilling down her face. That night, they sleep together, but the experience reveals another tragedy. Naoko had never been able to have intercourse with Kazuki. Their encounter becomes both connection and painful reminder. Days later, Naoko disappears. Months pass before Toru receives a letter explaining she's entered a sanatorium in the mountains outside Kyoto. When he visits, he discovers an unusual facility where patients and staff live as equals, growing food and focusing on accepting rather than correcting their deformities. There, he meets Reiko, Nawako's roommate, a woman in her 30s who teaches music therapy and has been there 7 years. Through Reiko, we learn Nawako's problems began before Kizuki's death. Her older sister had committed suicide at 17, the same age as Kizuki, leaving Nawako to discover her body. For 3 days afterward, she couldn't speak, lying like a dead person, eyes wide open. This trauma, combined with possible genetic predisposition, created vulnerabilities that Kizuki's suicide later exacerbated. The sanatorium becomes both refuge and trap safe, but making the outside world seem increasingly threatening. As winter gives way to spring 1970, Toru's life hangs in suspension. He passes exams, moves to Kichijoji, adopts a white cat named Seagull, tends a garden, yet feels unable to move forward while waiting for Naoko. Midori grows frustrated with his emotional unavailability, writing, "You're all locked up in that little world of yours," before refusing to speak to him for weeks. The novel offers no easy resolution, presenting the harsh reality that some wounds cannot be healed, only accommodated. As Reiko explains about the sanatorium's philosophy, "We're not here to correct deformities, but to accept them. Some losses leave permanent scars that change us irrevocably." This truth becomes devastatingly clear when Toru receives news of Naoko's suicide. Like Kizuki before her, she's chosen to end her suffering. The novel refuses to judge this choice, presenting it as the final act of someone who could no longer bear existence's weight. In the aftermath, Reiko visits Toru in Tokyo for an impromptu musical memorial, playing 50 songs on guitar, from Dear Heart to Norwegian Wood. For each song, Toru lays a match on a stone lantern, creating a visual representation of their shared grief. Before departing to teach music, Reiko tells him, "Be happy. Take my share and Naoko's and combine them for yourself." In the novel's final pages, Toru calls Midori from a crowded Tokyo street, declaring he wants to begin anew. When she asks where he is, he realizes he has no idea, geographically or emotionally. This disorientation perfectly captures his state of transition. The ambiguous ending deliberately refuses closure. We don't know if Midori will accept him or whether he can truly move beyond Naoko. The uncertainty mirrors the messy reality of human relationships, where neat conclusions are rare. What makes Norwegian Wood powerful is its refusal to offer tidy resolutions. Like real grief, the novel presents loss not as something we get over, but as something we carry, sometimes heavily, sometimes lightly, but always with us. The people we've loved become integral parts of who we are. Yet amid this melancholy runs a current of cautious hope, the possibility that we might honor our dead while still embracing life. As Reiko advises, grab whatever chance you have of happiness where you find it. Her words carry special weight coming from someone who has experienced profound loss, yet continues finding meaning in music and human connection. This wisdom forms the novel's beating heart, not easy optimism that denies suffering, but recognition that continuing to live fully requires courage. The past shapes us, but we choose whether it will imprison or inform us.